This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
In April 2019, the astronomers of the Event Horizon Telescope project revealed to the world the first ever image captured of a black hole. This episode, I got to speak to Professor Heino Falke, one of the lead scientists behind that incredible image, to find out more about the science of black holes and what it took to photograph one.
Yeah, I'm Heino Falke. I'm professor of radio astronomy and astroparticle physics from the Radboud University in Nijmegen in the Netherlands. And I'm passionate about black holes and a lot of other things in the universe, from the small scales to the biggest scales. And I was deeply involved in the first image of a black hole that was published 2 years ago. And I wrote a book about it, about the personal journey that I made with this experiment, and also about the journey that we made as humankind from the first view towards the stars, which must have been as fascinating at the time, thousands of years ago, as it is still today, if we still find a quiet and dark spot somewhere in our neighborhood.
Yeah, indeed. It's becoming increasingly difficult to get away from sort of light pollution and find dark places. But I sort of thought it'd be interesting to start the podcast with something that you've probably been asked loads of times. Can you give us a simple explanation as to what exactly a black hole is?
Just enormous amount of matter compressed into a tiny amount of space, which means that gravity and space-time curvature, which is, you know, Einstein's great idea about explaining gravity, becomes so extreme that everything that comes too close will never be able to escape. And that's why it's a black hole. It's not really a hole, right? It's a lot of stuff, but it's a hole in space and time, because it really punches a hole into our observable universe. There's something around this universe, in this universe, around this black hole, that we cannot see and measure with current technology, maybe never. And that's why this is a dark and mysterious region shielded by an event horizon where nothing escapes.
Yes, now that event horizon, if I'm right, that's the point beyond which nothing can escape?
Yes. So if you have matter collapsing, you have a big star exploding and it collapses into a black hole, you know, there is no force that can stop that collapse, because as more matter piles up and is quenched together, the force of gravity just becomes stronger and stronger and wants to pull it together even more. And there is, you know, no force that can stop this. And at some point it collapses into a point. And then surrounding this is this region where this is a perimeter, so to speak. And it's not just a line, it's actually a sphere, so to speak, a virtual sphere in space, where if you cross that border, you'd never be able to come back. And that's true for yourself if you walk into it, but it's also true for light. If it falls into a black hole, we'll never be able to come out. And so no information, nothing that goes in is able to come out, at least according to the theory of gravity. Hawking had some other ideas about it.
I often think it's really interesting when astrophysicists and scientists talk about space-time, like space and time are sort of intertwined to the point at which they are, you know, they sort of can't really be separated when you're talking about how they behave. So whenever you sort of hear about mass warping space-time and you know, so all that gravitational lensing and things like that. What's the physics behind that? So is a black hole so dense that it can actually sort of warp and curve time itself?
At least it's a theory that Einstein proposed to explain nature and the mysterious force of gravity. And it all boils down to the properties of light. Because if you think about what is space and what is time, have you ever touched space? Have you ever touched time? That's something you can get a grip on. How do you experience it? You measure it. You measure it with a device. And sometimes it's yourself. And time is relative. Sometimes it takes, the same few seconds can, feel like ages. And others go by way too fast. But on the basic level, you're always measuring space and time with light. And light is actually the only thing that's constant in the universe, if you talk about space and time. And that was a big realization of Albert Einstein, and he took that serious, that light always moves with the same speed. And that was deeply, deeply put and deeply ingrained in our theories of physics today, in the theory of light, in the theory, of course, of gravity, in the theories of information and everywhere, light always travels with the same speed. And what is speed? Speed is length divided by time, miles per hour, kilometers per hour. Okay? So the ratio between the two is fixed, but individually, the two can change. And so when you think of gravity as a change in space, gravity of a body leads to a deformation of space, then suddenly the length scale changes. Light has to travel a longer path, okay? But then also time needs to change to keep the velocity the same. Or at least what you measure as time changes. Because indeed, time is a derived quantity. It's not inherent to something. It's something that you always measure by a clock. How quickly is a clock ticking? And on the fundamental level, the clicking of the ticking of a clock is really the oscillation of the light waves or similar types of waves. And that changes as you go through curved space. And so you can never separate space and time if you take the fact serious that light is really what defines everything, and that light, the speed of light, is constant. And that's something we just measure. I mean, it sounds weird, but something, it was measured, and it was also baked in into the equations of Maxwell and others. And we use it every day, and we don't really know about it. And without that principle that the speed of light is constant, many of the things of the physics wouldn't work. So it was a logical consequence in the end that space and time is relative, but it took a long time for us to realize it.
I think all that sort of what I would regard anyway as complex, physics and theoretical physics, although you've put it on unbelievably succinctly and simply, it just makes that image of the black hole in galaxy M87 that was captured by you and the team about 2 years ago. It just makes it all the more mind blowing. I mean, if not even light can escape from a black hole, how is it possible to photograph a black hole, to capture an image of a black hole? I was wondering if you could just go all the way back and sort of explain a little bit about how that project came about and the actual science involved.
Yeah, how can you photograph a dark hole in a dark wall at night? You can't, right? There's no way to see it. What you have to do is you have to shine light at it, right? The light will disappear in the hole, and the light surrounding and the wall surrounding it will actually light up. And something like that is happening with black holes in general. Because if you look into them, what we're seeing in this picture is this dark region in the very center. You're looking really into the darkness of the event horizon. That's where light disappears. But surrounding it is an enormous amount of light. And that comes from the fact that the universe is not empty. Matter is falling into the black hole. It's heating up. It's actually rotating with the speed of light. It's some of the hottest material you can find is around black holes, and they make an awful amount of radiation and light. And so it shines upon itself, these black holes. And some of the light escapes, and we can measure it, and some of the light disappears in the darkness. And that's what we can see in the end. Of course, in our case, it was radio light, but that is light like the light we see. It's just a different frequency. It's just a color that we don't really know yet as humans. We measure it with devices, but it is light that's produced near the black hole. And I was starting my physics studies and was thinking about black holes, and then like you and many others, it was just like totally fascinating, mysterious, but unbelievable objects, really, right? So everything seems so strange. You hear that time slows down, almost actually comes to a standstill, that light just disappears, nothing comes out. And all these things, you travel around with speed of light, and you know, that looks really, it sounds really exotic. And but then there was evidence that these things might actually exist in the universe. And that was just, you know, in the 90s, this was a paradigm, but a thought, but we hadn't really established it, that this is true. And I wanted to see it. And then there was this realization that there, in some cases, you actually can see it. If a black hole is very, very big, and it's very, very close, and you look at the right radio frequency, then it will actually, the light will come from right next to the event horizon. And you should be able to see that ring. And we had just also built in the radio astronomy community where I'm coming from, had built the techniques to possibly do this. We just had to extrapolate that to much higher precision and higher frequencies than what we were doing in the 90s. So you put things together and say, wow, we may be able to see a black hole, actually. You know, this mysterious object. And that what really drove my passion and my life for the next 20, 25 years.
How did you decide to aim for the black hole in Galaxy M87?
That's to some degree luck. So when we published our first paper saying, you know, we can take a picture of the black hole, we were thinking of the black hole in the center of our galaxy in the Milky Way, because there we know exactly how big the mass is. And around the same time, people were measuring also other black holes like M87. But then it seemed that the mass was just too small. Right? You have a certain limited resolution. And that resolution is actually set by the size of the Earth, because we need a world-size telescope to see a black hole. And that's what we did in the end. But you cannot make the world much bigger easily, right? You have to go to space, but that's very expensive. So the size of the Earth sets a resolution. And it seemed that M87 was just a bit, tiny bit too small, factor two too small. And so we were gearing up for this experiment to look at the center of the Milky Way. And then slowly, in the next couple of years, actually 10 years, two decades, M87, the mass seemed to become bigger and bigger. Groups were measuring again and again and say, if I take my data serious, this thing should be as massive as 6 billion times the mass of the sun. And that's in itself incredible. I already found the original number of 2 to 3 billion almost incredible. But that just made it just barely resolvable. You know, we might have a shot at it. We weren't quite sure. And then we tried in 2017. We did the center of the Milky Way and we did M87 just to see what it would look like. Well, and a year later, I saw the first data. And when you saw that data, I just fell from my chair. I mean, actually, I wasn't on a chair. I was standing. I think I was just floating above the ground for about an hour. I said, this is so cool. I hope this is right. Because it meant that we had seen the shadow and that ring. And of course, what followed was a year of hectic and painful investigations of whether we did things right with this big collaboration of 250, and that 350 people actually were involved in this entire experiment, and many sleepless nights, but a very energetic team of many young scientists who put days and night into investigating this.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that you said there, which I wanted to pick up on, was that the telescope was the size of the Earth, because as I understand it, it was like an international array of radio telescopes. So you're connecting telescopes around the world to create one massive telescope? Is that sort of the idea?
Absolutely. And this is actually an old idea called interferometry, radio interferometry. It was even a Nobel Prize for this in the 70s in the UK. And Martin Ryle got this Nobel Prize for inventing interferometry. And that was an ingenious idea. You would be able to, rather than build a big telescope, because the bigger telescope, the bigger the resolution, you could use smaller telescope, separate them, and then you connect them electronically. First with just cables, like coax cables, you would then bring the light waves together via these cables. And then later, it was realized we can do this on even a bigger scale. We can separate telescopes over entire continents or even across, you know, the entire world. And then we record the data locally, and then we later bring the data together when what we have recorded. Initially, people recorded the radio wave on videotape, yeah, and then on these big computer tapes. And now we record them on hard drives. We actually store light on hard drives these days, and we can send it over via the internet. But we're having so much data that we still have to use hard drives to store all our data and handle all our data. And then you can synthesize a telescope in your computer, and you do exactly what a normal telescope would do. And we can do this because we have enough data processing power. We can do this in the radio. We cannot do this with light waves because they are too high frequency, too much data, and they have a quantum nature. But with radio waves, we can do this. We can just, you know, store them on hard drive and then do with them whatever we like, and we can form a virtual telescope and do what a world-sized telescope would do.
It's absolutely incredible.
And it's 40 years of work and more that went into this from an entire community of radio astronomers. And not the least, in fact, in the UK, which has always been the leading country in terms of radio astronomy since World War II, which I think goes back, if I remember, to the Royal Air Force. You know, their knowledge was built up in trying to find German fighter planes and developing radar technology and so forth. And so that's where the original knowledge came from. They used it then for astronomy right after the war.
Yes, that's right. It's the story of UK listeners will be familiar with Jodrell Bank Observatory in Cheshire in the UK, and I think Sir Bernard Lovell had begun using old World War II radio equipment to.
Yeah, he was in the RAF, and he had this idea. He saw something during the war that he wanted to follow up with in terms of physics. I think it was a cosmic rays even. He wasn't thinking of black holes. He was thinking of something completely different. And he wanted to follow this up after the war with radio dishes. And it turned to something completely, you know, something completely different. But then, you know, these big dishes were built, the big Lovell telescope, there's an Effelsberg telescope, and the Parkes telescope, these big dishes. But they are giants, and you can't make them bigger. And then the idea came, let's do interferometry. Let's separate them. Let's bring them together. If we use the perspectives from the entire world, we can actually make a world-sized telescope. And that made it possible. I think this is really an amazing story how something as terrible as World War II, in the end, something came out which was beneficial for science, and people actually started to work together across borders and across countries. So there's always some hope, I think, to find in this story.
Definitely. When we look at that image of the M87 black hole, what are we actually seeing in terms of the orange ring, and why is it sort of thicker and brighter and wider at the bottom?
Yeah, it actually looks pretty much like we predicted it before. You see, again, you see the darkness, which is the event horizon, light disappearing in the event horizon, and then light is actually bent around the black hole. In our simulations, what we see is light can even go on a circle. Light could go in a closed circle almost around the black hole because the force of gravity is so strong. And so that's what we're seeing. We're seeing light being bent by the black hole as a big gravitational lens, so to speak. And the plasma around the black hole is still rotating, right? It's still rotating with almost the speed of light. And then, you know, the stuff that comes towards us will appear a bit brighter because the light is actually beamed. It actually gets a push because the matter itself is moving almost with the speed of light. The light itself cannot move faster than speed of light, as I just explained, but you can sort of, you know, pile up light. You can give it more energy. And so that part that you're looking into that comes towards you will appear brighter to you. will also radiate at somewhat higher frequencies. And so we think that the lower part of this ring is something that rotates towards us. But of course, we only had one snapshot. You know, we took one particular picture in 1 week in 2017. And we know that the black holes can change their appearance so that stuff could move around. It could have been that just by accident, a big blob was brighter on one side. So we would have to average really of a number of turns to really get this sorted out very clearly. But it looks quite tantalizing. And as I said, it looks really almost exactly as it was predicted and calculated before, which doesn't happen that often in astronomy.
There was another image that came out about a week ago as we're recording, and it was the M87 black hole, but in polarized light, so it's sort of showing the magnetic field.
Yeah, you're not seeing the magnetic field. You see actually the direction within which the light is oscillating. You don't know this usually in your daily life, and you don't notice it, that light oscillates, but it can oscillate like from left to right or up and down. And using a special filter, like sunglasses, for example, sometimes do this, you can pick out which light you want to see, the one going from left to right or the one going up and down. Then you see only half the light. Your cell phones actually will produce polarized light. So if you use your polarized sunglasses and turn them around, you will actually see different reflections and parts on your cell phone. So that's something that is, you know, not very present in our daily lives, but it is there. In every light you look at is polarization information. So that's a hidden information. And the same is going on in black holes. The light that we measure is polarized. And where does this come from? What determines which direction the light waves are oscillating? It's the direction of magnetic fields. Because how is radio emission produced? Well, it's sort of electrons going up and down or left or right. And near black holes is strong magnetic fields, electrons going around the magnetic fields. And so that tells you then the polarization direction and the direction of magnetic fields. In fact, if you look at these fine lines now that we plot on this image that we showed, this shows the direction of polarization. And the magnetic fields are roughly perpendicular to that.
Absolutely incredible. I think it's worth actually also talking about, because all this information and the story of how the black hole was captured is all part of your new book, which is how our paths have sort of crossed. Your book, Light in the Darkness, which is going to be coming out, I think, around about the time this podcast is out. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that title means, Light in the Darkness, and what the book itself is about.
Well, to me, looking at this black hole is a bit of an end point, but also beginning of something new. If you think about how we started as humans, we were looking up at the night sky and we saw these lights coming in, this light in the darkness. And it was always telling us something. There's something bigger, something more fascinating, something deeper out there. And I think the same feeling we still have today as astronomers, but also as amateurs and just, you know, average people, we look at the sky and this light tells us about something deeper and more meaningful. And we learned so much physics, so much about our universe, about the nature of space-time from just a little bit of light, that really drove a lot of development of of humanity, I think. And so I tell a little bit the story of astronomy from this first view until the end. And now I have a bit of the feeling we've gone almost all the way. We've looked at the beginning of space and time, the Big Bang. We've looked at the light from the Big Bang. We're looking now at the end of space-time, black holes, the end of space and time, and everything in between. Yes, there's still so much more to discover, but we've really, you know, gotten to the absolute limit of space and time. And then the big question is, what's next? You know, are we ever able to transcend those boundaries? I mean, think about it. You know, would you have thought about 2,500 years ago? You can really see the universe in the making in the Big Bang and something as crazy as black holes. And what's still for us to come? And I think that's an interesting question because I'm not able to answer this. Because, you know, physics right now tells us there is a fundamental limit, right? Until here and not further, right? But There's always a hope that there's something new to be discovered. Maybe some new theory of gravity at the edge of black holes. And so we'll keep searching. And I think that really, that's what makes us human, to search and ask the deep questions about us, the universe, the origin, the meaning of life, God, and whatever. And I try to use this title to express, it's just not about physics, you know. It's also deeply about fascination and fundamental questions that we always ask. You know, I didn't go into astronomy just to just do physics. I mean, it was always a deeper fascination that drew me into the field.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose your own faith must play a large part in that, because you're an ordained Christian minister, aren't you, in your hometown in Germany?
I was raised and born as a Protestant Christian, and my faith means something to me. It's something that has been part of my life throughout my early days until now as a scientist, and it's been something that has been very important to me, and something that I think I share with many people throughout, again, the many generations who've not only looked at nature as something, but as an expression of something deeper, as an expression of a first cause. You know, who, where does it all come from? Where do we go to? And to me, the feeling there is a creator, a God, a first thing, is something that really gives me strength, and also to think about this together with other fellow Christians and other believers, to ask these questions and reflect on it, and to allow myself to be a bit spiritual as well in light of all the hardcore physics that we do. I think that's important for our humanity as well.
Yeah, I also think it's sort of analyzing the universe and its beginning and its end and all those kind of theoretical cosmology and astrophysics, bringing in a bit of religion or spirituality, as you said, it also sort of reminds us of the poetry of the universe and the actual beauty of things. Which do you find as a sort of hardcore physicist and academic that there's a tendency to sort of get lost in the numbers and the maths and it helps to sometimes actually take a step back and remember just how beautiful everything is?
Absolutely. I think that's really the point. I still remember, like, when I was somewhat younger, the question of the beginning of the universe, it was still present in our field. And nowadays we only talk about numbers and hardcore physics. That's all fine. I love it. You know, it's great. But whenever I'm allowed to give a talk to, like, the general public and talk about it and the general meaning of astronomy, and you talk about this, the beauty of the universe and how this all works, and the fact that we are allowed to see it and understand it, I'm always awestruck. You know, I stand there and it almost feels a little bit like holy to look at this universe. If you step a bit back and you go away from the numbers and just think about the big picture. And I have a bit of the impression that we lost a little bit the ability to speak about this and express this also in terms that are not just numbers, but again, express some of our spiritual feelings about this, because that have shaped our universe. In fact, astronomy has been the oldest science. It came out of sort of people trying to understand what's going on, and they were thinking about gods and so forth. And of course, actually very quickly, the two separated. Some people were observing the stars, the other ones were interpreting this. And today we don't use equations to really express the meaning of life, but the question is still there. And I think theology and these other fields and philosophy that have been around for many centuries shouldn't be discounted now only because we are bad at math.
The other thing I keep coming back to when we're considering, all these sort of cosmological queries is that idea that we only can really see about 5% of the universe, the rest sort of being dark matter and dark energy. How can we hope to actually understand all those those unknowns about the universe. Do you think we're sort of getting any closer?
That's a very good question. And indeed, the more we've looked into the universe, this is, of course, something we always say, but it seems to remain true. The more we look into the universe, the more questions come up. And some we may never be able to answer. I don't think we'll be able to explain ever what the true origin of the universe is. We'll be able to understand some of the details, like what is dark energy and dark matter? sorry for calling it detail. It's one of the big questions today. But I think on the large scale things, I'm quite hopeful that we'll be able to understand them. And there may be some really exciting stuff behind it. One colleague of mine once said, we all think of dark matter as one thing, but maybe this dark universe is much more complex and exciting than we think, right? So maybe there's much more deeper things hiding there. And it will definitely give us a better understanding of space and time. And remind you, if black holes, we understand them from the theory of relativity, but we do not understand them at all from the theory of quantum physics. Right? There is a quantum theory of it, which is well-developed mathematically, but has many, many different branches, many, many different ideas, and is hardly, if at all, tested. Right? So there's an entire universe that we do not understand in theory and in practice, and it's going to be very hard to observe it. So there are still challenges out there for us, and I think there may be some really exciting stuff to discover. Not everything that you see in science fiction these days will be able to to realize, but maybe a few things that we now consider totally crazy will be quite commonplace in 1,000 years.
I hope so, and I hope that that you and I get to sort of live long enough to get answers to some of those questions.
Well, with 1,000 years will be tough, but I'm pretty sure the next in astronomy every year almost something new happens. And, people rightly say it's been such an amazing decade already. They're looking forward to what the next decade brings. It's exciting. It's I would call it this last battle that we have. I mean, either we're going to have some really exciting ones or we're actually banging our heads against the wall. We're not going through. And so it really is an exciting time that we're going into now.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much for speaking to me today, Hainu. And also want to say good luck with the book when it comes out.
Thank you.
Good luck with your future research, and hope we get to speak to you again sometime soon.
Oh, I'm happy to be back.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky Night Magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skynightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or your favourite podcast provider.